class. We encourage you, along with all of our regular students, to get out your smartphone, scan that QR code that's on the screen, or use your browser to go to slido.com and put in the Embry Hills code, and you'll be connected to the interactive learning platform that we're going to be using during our class. A couple activities that we have throughout the class period that will help you to engage with the rest of us and even potentially ask questions. I've asked Larry Brown to lead us in an opening prayer, and after he does that, we'll get started. Very good. So if you're plugged in to Slido, you'll see there on the polls tab an opportunity for you to connect to this first quiz that we're going to be a part of. You do not have to put your name in. You can be anonymous if you wish, but you cannot claim any prizes after the class is over if we don't know who you are. I see some of our regular competitors are already queued up and ready to go. But as we proceed, you can continue to scan or join and participate in whichever of these questions you want to participate in. So we're reviewing. We're looking at two of the minor prophets, Hosea and Amos. When did they prophesy? Were they prophesying to the people of Judah, the southern kingdom, warning them of the imminent fall of Jerusalem to Nebuchadnezzar? Did they live early in the northern kingdom, decrying the golden calf worship of King Jeroboam I? Or did they live during the peaceful reign of Jeroboam II, warning of the impending destruction of Samaria at the hands of the Assyrians? Or did they prophesy to the exiles returning from Babylon, encouraging them to finish rebuilding the temple? Let's see what we've got so far. We've got a number I can't read from a distance anymore, but about half of you have given an answer. And it looks like most of you have gotten the right answer. This is late in the period of the northern kingdom. It was about 750 B.C. or so, only a few decades before the Assyrian Empire is going to come and completely take the people away and uproot them and scatter them throughout the rest of the empire and destroy the city of Samaria in particular that we'll see in our chapter today. So those are the other prophets. There were other prophets that did those other three things, but they weren't Hosea and Amos. So we're just trying to get us dialed into who we're talking about this morning. The prophet Hosea, which one of these is true for the prophet Hosea? Was he a farmer from Judah who preached to the northern kingdom as an outsider? Did he marry a harlot at God's direction and used his experience to illustrate the people's unfaithfulness and God's love for his people? Did he open his book with a message of condemnation to the surrounding heathen nations all around Israel? Or does he frequently condemn the social injustice among the people, more so than Amos does? Which of these best fits Hosea? Let's see what we've got here. Oh, we're getting a pretty dominant answer here. It's an easy one if you remember Hosea's story, right? He was the one that married the harlot. God told him to go marry a woman of harlotry, and that personal experience enabled him to preach the message of God's love and the people's unfaithfulness to the northern kingdom. So what about Amos? What do we remember? Oh, by the way, the other statements there, all true about Amos, right? Here, we're talking about Amos now. Which one of these four best describes Amos? Was he told by one of the king's priests at Bethel to go back home to Judah and prophesy down there? Or did he emphasize the loving kindness of God toward his people? Was he a father to three children, born to his wife Gomer? Or did he preach that God delights in loyalty rather than sacrifice? Three of those are true for Hosea. Which one of these is true for Amos? Okay, I thought this one might trip up some people. There's a little division here between which one is it was correct. The best answer is the first. He was the one, we'll get to that in chapter 7 in a couple of weeks, told by the priest, I think Amaziah was his name, go back where you came from. You're not wanted here. He did preach that sacrifice was not the most important thing. We looked at that in chapter 5, right? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. I hate your new moon festivals and your sacrifices. He had that. But this loyalty better than sacrifice. That's a quote from Hosea. So, okay, I tricked you a little bit on that one. But we got to have some way of separating the wheat from the chaff, right? So... All right, we'll have a couple more questions later on, some other exercises as part of this platform as we get through the rest of the chapter. But first, an exercise. I want us all to think about this scenario, purely hypothetical. But imagine yourself as an Israelite farmer during this time of Amos and Hosea in the Northern Kingdom, a very agricultural society. Wealth was measured largely in terms of your land and your crops and your livestock. You assume responsibility for your family's land at a very young age, right? Each family had an inheritance, and you're a young man, and you take charge of your family's farm, and you do a really good job. Through God's blessing and your own hard work and initiative and wisdom, your farm prospers. You're able to have successful crops when others maybe are struggling because you're really good at this. You expand your farming operation by acquiring land from other farmers. Growth, right? That's what it's all about. You start with a small tract, and then you expand and take other tracts. When you succeed in years when others are failing and they need to come to you for help or borrow money from you or whatever, you reach a point where you're able to help these other farmers. You're able to rescue them from your prosperity. And so you get their land. They work for you. They essentially become your employees, farming their land for you, and their debts are paid off, and everyone wins in this arrangement. You expand your business, and you and your sons and their sons continue to grow your agribusiness year after year after year until, after 50 years, you've accumulated so much wealth that you can live a comfortable life, even a luxurious life, that you can pass down to your heirs. So my question is, what would God have to say to you here in the Northern Kingdom if this were you? If this had been your life, you were reaching the end of your life, and you look to the law of God to see what you should do with all of that. Here's the question. Get out your smartphone. Which of these do you think best describes what the law of God would say to a person like that? Would the law say, well, you should be commended for your wise stewardship of the resources God has provided you and rewarded with generational wealth for your descendants? Would the law say you should donate 10% of your profits to benefit the poor? Or maybe when you die, I mean, after 50 years, you're getting close to the end here, when you die, half of your property and your estate would go to the king. Is that a provision of the law? Or is it all of these things? Or is it none of these things? So none of you had a chance to really study this particular issue, so you might be a little reluctant to answer, but we'll give you a minute or two to pick one. People are being shy. I only see, what, a dozen answers so far. Okay. Well, none of the above is the right answer. All right, so raise your hand if you said none of the above. All right, so you none of the above-ers. What's the right answer? What would the law say? The year of Jubilee, yeah, so I gave you a little hint if you didn't see here. We're in Leviticus chapter 25, the year of Jubilee, and the 50 year was the key. What happened on the year of Jubilee, every 50th year in the land? Everything had to go back to the original inheritor. So if you had taken over land that belonged to someone else, you had to return it to that family. If someone had gone into your debt and became a slave or a servant to you, you were obligated to release them and send them back to their family. So property and family were the two big things that had to be reset, basically, every half century. And this is all part of the Sabbath scheme, right? There were Sabbath years every seventh year. The land was to rest. And then after seven Sabbaths, the 49th year or the 50th year would be a year of Jubilee. And this whole chapter prescribes different regulations pertaining to that year. Everything goes back to where it came from. Every property owner gets what they had. And that would be factored into any transactions over real estate, right? If the year of Jubilee was 2 years from now, you couldn't charge full price for a piece of land. You're basically leasing it for a period of time. As he says here, it's the number of crops that he's selling to you, not the actual land itself. If you're worried about how we're going to feed ourselves, God has provisions. You've got to trust in God that he's going to bless you enough produce from the land to last you through the years that you're not farming the land until the year of Jubilee is over. But the basic idea here is the land shall not be sold permanently, for it's mine, and you are aliens and sojourners with me. This is all stuff that God gave you in the first place, so you have no right to keep it forever and ever, so to speak. Now, we skip down. There's lots of other provisions here. Later in the chapter, verse 35, we're talking about poor people. If people become poor and they're indebted to you, you're not to treat them like a slave. You are to sustain them like a stranger or sojourner, that he may live with you. Do what you can to help them. Don't charge them excessive interest. And if things get so bad here, if they become so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, don't treat him like a slave. He'll be like a hired man, like an employee to you. And then in the year of Jubilee, he goes back to freedom. He goes back to his family where he was. For they are my servants who I brought out of the land of Egypt. You have no right to treat them as slaves to yourself. So when you think about all these provisions, and there are others in the law was designed to help the poor. This year of Jubilee system, first of all, reminds the people that the land they have belongs to God. It's not theirs. It's something they've been trusted with. Reminds the people that all of them were once slaves, right? Well, we've already seen this in Amos and Hosea, the hearkening back to, I was the one who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Don't forget that. They owe their freedom to God to begin with. So they have no right to go enslaving anyone else. It obligates the wealthy to take care of the poor. That's how it worked. If you had means and other people had need, it was up to you with the wealth, you with the means, to help take care of them. Prevents any family from completely losing their inheritance. Yes, they may fall in hard times. Yes, they may struggle. But these provisions of the law ensure that they get by somehow. And eventually, when the year of Jubilee would come, would get their inheritance redeemed for them and be able to start over again. But it also prevents any family from becoming so wealthy at the expense of other that generational wealth that we've had in our example, that can't happen. You can't get that wealthy, because every 50 years, everything sort of resets to itself. Now, with that description of how God's law worked, and there are plenty of other examples where God makes provisions for the poor, given what we've already seen in Amos and Hosea, have the people been following this very closely, do you think? Not hardly at all. We've already seen the chapters we looked at. They sell the righteous for money and the needy for a pair of sandals. They're greedy people and have no qualms about taking from the poor to further enrich themselves. Chapter 4, the cows of Bashan who oppress the poor, crush the needy, who say to their husbands, bring me that we may drink. You know, bring me another drink. Serve me. These wealthy women crushing the poor. You impose heavy rent on the poor and exact a tribute of grain from them. They're not trying to help them. They're not trying to give them low interest or no interest loans. They're further requiring things from them. And who distress the righteous and accept bribes and turn aside the poor in the gate. We talked about how the gate of the city was where business was transactions, civic affairs were taken care of, and the justice system had been corrupted. The judges taking bribes. The people that had wealth would pay off the people who made the decisions, and the people who were poor had no one to turn to. They only became poorer, and the richer became richer. It's this abuse of those who don't have so much, so that those who have the wealth can keep it and grow it at the expense of others, that is condemned so strongly, particularly here in Amos. That brings us now to chapter 6 of Amos, if you want to turn there. That's where we're going to be looking at to start. Another famous passage describing these folks. But we want to consider what it is about their wealth in particular that is being highlighted in this chapter, because it's been talked about a lot. But you see here, being in verse 4, we're going to start in the middle of the chapter. I apologize for that, but this leads into our example here. Those who recline on beds of ivory and sprawl on their couches. What does that bring to mind? Are these people working hard for a living? They're relaxing and taking it easy. This is the lap of luxury here, the sprawling. You'll see the last verse here, the sprawler's banqueting. That's sort of a good description or summary of this whole image being described here. They eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall. Is he condemning them for being meat eaters or eating meat at all? It's more just they have all the meat they could possibly want to have. The very best meat, and whenever they want it, they can have it as part of this banquet. Who improvise to the sound of a harp and, like David, have composed songs for themselves. There's music being played, but is this music in service to God or in honor of God? The idea seems to be here that this may even be a pagan festival. Because remember, there was idolatry throughout the society as well, and this may well be tied to that. This drinking wine from the sacrificial bowls, while they anoint themselves with the finest of oils. So they have these luxurious accoutrements here as part of their pagan worship. Yet, despite all of that, they are enjoying all the luxuries you can imagine. They have not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. Now, that could be a reference to the spiritual depravity of the nation. Everyone pretty much participated in that. But in the context, it could well be that the poor people that they're crushing and the poor people they're oppressing and the poor people that they're denying justice to, they have no concern about them. It's all about me, all about maintaining my wealth, my luxury, my lifestyle, my sprawler's banquet, and I don't care about anybody else. So what does the Lord have to say? These folks are going to be at the head of the class. These are the ones that will go out first when the judgment comes, the Assyrians come, and the exiles come to pass. So you just see in Amos's tone here how much, what's the word I'm looking for? How much he just can't stand these excessive displays of their luxury while everyone else is suffering in some way. If you go on to the beginning of the chapter now, this is how he starts the message to these people. Woe to those who are at ease in Zion. And that could be a reference to Jerusalem, which could suggest even the southern kingdom. They're getting involved in this too. And to those who feel secure in the mountain of Samaria. What does extreme wealth tend to do to people, by the way, in terms of their view of their future? Do you trust in yourself? Do you trust in your stuff? They've developed this sense of false security. That's our theme today, by the way, if you looked at your lesson sheet here. And they're in the mountain of Samaria, by the way. It's a walled city. It's up in the highlands. It's in the center part of the country. It's far away from Assyria or any other aggressor. You might think that we're in the interior here. No one can get to us. We're having our banquets and our parties and enjoying all of our wealth, and no harm can befall us. That seems to be the attitude here. The distinguished men of the foremost of nations to whom the house of Israel comes. Everyone comes from. These are the upper crust, the elite, the wealthiest of the wealthy. And Amos has a woe to deliver to these people. Verse 2 here introduces a couple of locations. Go over to Calneh and look, and go from there to Hamath the Great, then go down to Gath and the Philistines. Are they better than these kingdoms? Are these territories better than yours? There's a little uncertainty as to where one of these places are. But again, this is Amos. Remember, Amos began with his panoramic tour of the surrounding nations, right? Would go from one place to the other and name off city after city, country after country, and all the vicious cruelty they were guilty of. He's kind of doing it again here. He's telling those folks in the mountain of Samaria, thinking they've got it all going good, go look at these other places. So this is Samaria, as we said, right here in the middle of the country, up in the mountains, safe and secure. He's telling them, go look at this place way up north. Hamath, and we think Calneh was up here even further north than Hamath was. They're sort of frontier towns. They're very close to the core territory of the Assyrian Empire, which is waxing and waning over the time. If you remember from 2 Kings, Jeroboam II expanded the territory of the country, right? The Lord blessed him. Remember, peace and prosperity during the time of this king. He was able to expand the territory of Israel all the way up to this area of Hamath here. We see a reference to Hamath during the time of David and Solomon. Solomon built stuff up in Hamath. That was sort of at the apex, right, of the territory that the Israelites had. They went up that far north. But this particular area had changed hands a number of times. And the implication seems to be, as great a city as it is, and Amos calls it Hamath the Great, they either have or would soon, perhaps, fall victim to the Assyrian hordes when they come in to take this town. And sort of the point seems to be, are you any better than these people? You think you're all secure now. These people thought they were all secure, and they're about to get slammed here by the Assyrians, and likewise this other city up here. But then he tells them, after going up there, go down to Gath of the Philistines. The Philistines were here in the south. We've already talked about the Philistines in the first chapter of Amos, where he names four of the five cities of the Philistines. And we said he left one out. Which one did he leave out? You remember? It's the one that's mentioned here in chapter 6, right? Gath. Go to Gath. Do you remember what we said was unique about Gath during this time? All right. Uzziah, the king of the south, who's contemporary of Jeroboam here, had gone in and conquered Gath. There wasn't much to Gath anymore. They had just been defeated. They had just been judged by God using Uzziah as his instrument. And so Amos is pointing to them. Are you any better than Gath? Think about what happened to Gath. They thought they had things going pretty good. And yet God, when he was ready to judge them, was able to destroy them. So the warning here seems to be, and there's some debate as to exactly what these rhetorical questions are referring to, but he seems to be going after this false sense of security, that we're here in the mountain of Samaria, having our sprawlers' banquets, everything's great, we have nothing to fear, and yet there are examples all around them of how God has judged those who defy him, and brought upon them this day of calamity. They think they can put off the day of calamity as long as they want. And while they're doing that, they can bring near the seat of violence. We didn't talk about the bloodshed, but a lot of the suppressing of the poor and crushing the needy literally involved murder and theft and other bloody sorts of activities that the people were guilty of. They continued to propagate those activities while thinking, the day of judgment is never going to come, or coming later and later and later. So when we expanded the whole first part of this chapter, and we see the emphasis on the ease and the security that the people felt, when we see how they're thinking that the day of judgment is way off in the future, that day of calamity, when they continue these violent practices that help them to expand their wealth and maintain their wealth, the sprawlers banqueting that we see in verses 4 through 7 there, combined with the fact that they're giving no concern at all for the poor or the moral conditions of the nation, whatever it is. What is God's view of a people like this? Well, the next verse gives us a hint. I hate the arrogance of Jacob. And I think that's what's really being brought out here. I mean, there are a lot of bad things going on in this chapter, but it's this juxtaposition of all the wealth they have and all the security that they think they have and how they're trusting in that to sustain them while ignoring what God tells them to do, while ignoring the warnings from Amos, while continuing to do all the bad things they're supposed to do, and that puffs up their pride, other translations. It's their arrogance, thinking that they're going to get away with this. Nothing bad can happen to me, right? I'm in Samaria here. These other places, yeah, stuff may go down there, but, you know, we're God's people. Nothing can happen to us. And so when you look a little closer, the message that Amos has, these verses 9 through 11, could that picture be any more different from the sprawlers' banquet that we've just talked about? Everyone sitting in the lap of luxury, enjoying the feasts and the music and the drink, the party. in this chapter, what do we see over and over again? Or these verses, 9 through 11. What jumps out at you from those verses? I'm doing all the talking here, so I'll pause for a minute. Is this a scene of happiness and revelry and partying? And okay, this is a scene of death in a very dramatic way. And it comes home, so to speak. You see the word house, as you see here, over and over and over again. If 10 men are left in one house, they're all going to die. Then one's uncle or undertaker will lift him up to carry out his bones from his house. And he will say to the one who's in the innermost of the house, "Is anyone else there with you?" And that one voice will say, "No one's here." Then he'll answer, "Keep quiet, for the name of the Lord is not to be mentioned." This is a picture after God's judgment has come. No one dares speak the name of the Lord anymore after what the Lord has done to the people here. Everyone's dead. This term undertaker here, some translations, well, the term seems to suggest maybe someone undertaking cremation. The Jews didn't cremate people, right? They buried people, and they buried them outside somewhere. But this suggests a scale of death and devastation so swift and so vast that there's no opportunity to do that. We've got to just take these bodies and burn them, because that's all the choice that we have. "For behold, the Lord is going to command that the great house be smashed to pieces and the small house to fragments." Big or small, high or low, wealthy or not, everything is going to be destroyed. And that's quite the stark contrast from the sprawlers' banqueting that we see earlier here. How serious is the Lord about his commitment to doing this? My brother Larry Brown is our resident expert on the names of God. He mentioned to me after our last class that Amos uses a number of different terms in Hebrew for the name of God. And several of them are here. I don't have it highlighted, but verse 8, "The Lord God has sworn by himself, the Lord God of hosts has declared." Several things going on here. You'll see that even the typography is different. This Lord God is a different term than this Lord God, or this Lord. I think that's Jehovah, right? God of hosts. This is an L, a Lord Sabaoth. The Lord of hosts, what does that bring to mind? He's used hosts before. Hosts of what? Armies, yeah. This is the Lord ready to do battle. This is the Lord ready to wreak judgment upon those that he has condemned. He's ready to go. And he has sworn by himself. The Hebrew writer makes that point in regard to the priesthood of Jesus, Melchizedek, and all that chapter, right? He is interposed with an oath, two unchangeable things. The Lord cannot lie, and then he's sworn by himself. A double oath to underscore just how committed the Lord is to keeping this promise. "I loathe the arrogance of Jacob. I detest his citadels. Therefore, I will deliver up the city and all that it contains." And you get this picture of the house-to-house search for dead bodies so that they can be burned. Quite a contrast. Now, if you're hearing this, right, if you're at the party and you're hearing Amos say all this, what are you likely to think? He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just that crazy old sheep herder from the south. You know, he's a crusty old guy that has nothing good to say. But this is the message from God. And this is the reality that in just a few decades would become real for the people of Israel. The chapter concludes here. A couple sort of rhetorical questions. Do horses run on rocks? Well, no. Does one plow with an oxen? That makes no sense. Yet you have turned justice into poison and the fruit of righteousness into wormwood. Those are two key words, right? Justice, righteousness. Amos has used them time and again. And a similar reference that we've seen before, how you've twisted things around. When people seek justice instead, they're getting poison. Instead of doing righteousness, it's this bitter wormwood that the people have produced. They've turned everything upside down. And then the last two verses here. This Lodabar, and however you pronounce this word here. Some translations aren't going to use those names. They'll say something, you rejoice in nothingness. This word means nothing. This means a horns, which is a sign of strength. It's actually apparently a play on words in Hebrew. These two places may actually be cities that during the expansion under Jeroboam II the Israelites were able to capture or retake, because between Syria and Assyria, a lot of towns on the frontier had gone back and forth over the years. And it seems to be that these in Samaria and these revelers and these people who think they've got it made and they have nothing to fear are pointing to their victories at these two places as signs of their strength and sign of God's blessing upon them. After all, the Lord did allow Jeroboam II to have this expansion. And they're pointing to that. So have we not by our own strength taken these places? And again, it's a play on words. They may be real places, but they're really nothing. Okay, they're taking pride in an accomplishment that is not significant at all, capturing some little border village somewhere that really doesn't amount to anything, especially when compared with what God is promising them here. Behold, I'm going to raise up a nation against you, O house of Israel, declares the Lord God of hosts again, and they will afflict you from the entrance of Hamath, way up in the north, to the brook of the Arabah, way down in the south. The whole scope of whatever territory Israel had. The Lord is going to come in and take it all, okay? Not just a couple little towns over here. So don't think that you're so high and mighty because you had that victory in those little towns. The Lord is coming with his hosts, and they're going to wipe you out completely. It's an image of judgment that is pretty significant. So the question for us, considering this chapter, move on here. So what does this mean for us, right? Our theme is false security. We've seen, I hope, the different ways in which the Israelites trusted in things, thinking that no harm could befall them, they could practice whatever wickedness they wanted, and God would either protect them or certainly not harm them. So the question I have for you, and get out your smartphone and you can provide us an answer, what are some things that we rely on, false things, for our security rather than trusting in the Lord? Money, wealth, flipped right before my eyes. Keep them coming. There's more. But that's an obvious one, especially comparing with the Israelites. The wealth that they had acquired at the expense of other people and depended on that, trusted in that to protect them. We do that with our 401ks or our bank account. We think as long as I have financial stability, then I really have nothing to worry about. Possessions, family, yeah. I come from a good family, or I have family to take care of me. But as Scott pointed out in our meeting last week, family can dissipate as well. Our intellect, that's something, I'm a really smart person, so I've got nothing to worry about. But that can fade as well, and that can deceive us. Our relationships, possessions, our education, our career, lots of different things that have real tangible value to them, but aren't things that can be relied on the same way as God can. And if we rely on these things for security, but disregard what the Lord teaches us and how we live our lives, then we're really deceiving ourselves, right? What did Paul have to say to Timothy about those that had wealth? I meant to find the verse here. 1 Timothy 6:17. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. We got stuff, and we're tempted to think that stuff is what's going to preserve us, but it's not the stuff. God gave that to you. It's God that we need to trust. All right, I am a little behind schedule. So we're going to move to the other chapter we're going to look at in Hosea. Flip back to Hosea chapter 7. And a slightly different theme. There are a lot of things going on in this chapter. We're not going to be able to discuss every single one. But we want to consider again this idea of false security, turning to things other than the Lord for things that the Lord should be supplying to us. We see here in the first verses, again, descriptions of false dealing, thieves and bandits, evil deeds, the wickedness of Ephraim. The Lord is going to uncover all that. When we're doing wicked things, are we often considering that, hey, God's going to know about all this stuff I'm doing? If you're really aware of God's presence and aware of God's oversight of your life, that doesn't lead you to think that you can get away with doing whatever wickedness you want to do. They do not consider in their hearts that I remember their wickedness. Now their deeds are all around them there before my face. So people have completely forgotten about God. And we'll see that evidence in the later verses of the chapter. This next section is about every commentator you read is going to say that commentators say that it's difficult to comment on what this is really talking about because there's a lot of uncertainty as to exactly what all these things are referring to. But if you see all these different phrases talking about the king and his princes and all their different activities, the rulers, this seems to be a description of what's going on among the ruling class in Israel. And you see the activities. There's this constant image of the heated oven stirring up the fire. Their hearts are like an oven. Their anger smolders all night. It burns like a flaming fire. It's hot like an oven. There's some sort of passionate, intense activity going on here, consuming the rulers. All their kings have fallen. All this plotting and scheming. And the last phrase, none of them calls on me. So it's some description of some pretty intricate activity going on among kings and princes and rulers, all of which has nothing to do with seeking God or turning to God for anything. So we don't have time to go through the whole history here. We've talked about how Jeroboam II reigned for a long time, 40 or 50 years, I think 40 years, peaceful, prosperous time. But then his son Zechariah only ruled for 6 months. He was the last of the line of Jehu, the four kings that were promised to Jehu, and the judgment came to pass because this guy Shallum came up from among the ranks and overthrew him, assassinated him. He only lasted a month before he himself was killed by the next king who ruled for a few years and did some interesting things. He had a son, though, but he didn't reign for a couple of years before he was assassinated by the next guy who came in. He had a 20-year reign, but he himself was overthrown as things were starting to fall apart in Israel. And the last king was really more of a puppet of the Assyrians before he himself was deported and imprisoned in Assyria. And the kingdom itself fell in about 722 B.C. But the contrast between years of peaceful, stable rule with all of these assassinations and plots and coups and overthrows and internal strife and political divisions. And what I don't show in here is how the Assyrians are starting to encroach upon the land during the times of these kings. And you see them starting to pay tribute to the kings. You see them trying to get out of paying tribute to the Assyrians. You see them forming alliances with the Syrians and the Israelites to try to fight against the Assyrians, and then they fight against themselves when the southern kingdom doesn't go along with that plan. So lots of fighting, instability, trying to avoid the inevitable domination by the Assyrians that's coming. They'll turn to the Egyptians in some cases to try to get them to bolster their kingdom against the rising power of Assyria. So it could well be that this whole section here describing the oven and the kings and the princes and no one calling on the Lord, because all of these were pretty rotten kings, is a description, in Hosea's terms, of all this turmoil that's going on among the leadership. Then the latter half of the chapter, we have the four famous images that Hosea uses to describe Israel or Ephraim. Ephraim mixes himself with the nations. He has become a cake not turned. And the idea there is more like pancake, right? It's cooked on one side, but raw on the other side because it's not been turned. It's half done, half not. And that seems to be a result of this mixing with the nations. Now, that could refer to a lot of things. Culturally, they have mixed with the nations for a long time, haven't they? That's where a lot of this idolatry came from in the first place. But the political alliances that we just referred to could also be part of what's involved here. Instead of turning to God and relying on him for deliverance, they're turning to other nations and other alliances and political factions to try, among the nations, to try to get the help that they need. Strangers devour his strength, but he doesn't know it. Gray hairs are also sprinkled on him, yet he does not know it. The gray hair is another image. The idea seems to be premature aging. They don't realize that their strength has been consumed, and they're older than they think. They're closer to the end than they realize. Again, similar to what the false security of Samaria we saw in Amos. Yet they have not returned to the Lord their God. That's, again, the theme through this chapter. Despite all the trouble they're facing, and they're seeking help in all these different from all these different sources, they're refusing to return to God. Instead, they're this silly dove, this bird that's flitting back and forth between Egypt on one side, Assyria on the other side. They're going from one to the other, hoping that one of them can save them. But what's going to happen is God is going to cast his net and capture them like the rest of the birds of the sky, and they will be punished. They're fruitlessly trying to find deliverance from these foreign powers instead of seeking the Lord, who's the only one who could deliver them. You see in these latter verses all the different ways that Israel has turned away from the Lord. They've strayed from me, rebelled against me. They speak lies against me. They don't cry to me from their heart. They're only concerned about grain and new wine, you know, material things. They're not interested in serving the Lord or seeking to know him. They turn away from me. Although I trained and strengthened their arms, whatever power and ability they have came from God, yet they devise evil against me. They are opposed to the Lord. They turn, but not upward. They are like a deceitful bow. That seems to be the idea. You have a good bow and you fling an arrow, it goes where you aim it. But a deceitful bow, it turns a different direction. It doesn't go where it's aimed. Despite all the aiming God has given them, when the bow is, the arrow is fired, it doesn't turn to the Lord. It turns to all these other places. And so the princes will get their judgment, falling by the sword and be derided in the land of Egypt. So with that, the question we want to ask ourselves is, when we are in trouble, where do we often turn for help instead of God? So in Amos, the picture there was everything's great. We've got all this luxury. We have everything we need. We have all the strength and security. We have nothing to worry about. In Hosea, well, things are starting to go bad. We're starting to worry about things. The Assyrians are starting to take away our people. I didn't mention that, but some of those, during the reign of some of those kings, the Assyrians started to take territory, and the exile began. They started taking people away. What are we going to do when this looming power is starting to beat down on us? Where do we turn? Where do we go? None of them called on the Lord. They turned away from the Lord. The Lord never seemed to enter their mind as an option to turn to for help. And instead, they go to Egypt, they go to Assyria, they go to the Syrians, they go to Judah, they go to everywhere else trying to find help. So what do we do? Wow, Google. Okay, yeah. Google has become our source of deliverance. If you want to know how to get out of a problem, just Google it. Of course, what is Google going to provide for you? Where is that wisdom going to come from? Is Google a search engine into the mind of God? It's going to tell you what man thinks about your problem. If you have problems in your marriage, you can find all sorts of worldly sources to tell you how to get out of that trouble. Is it always going to be what God says you need to do? If you're having issues with your children and trying to raise them, as we had last week a discussion about, the world has all kinds of theories and advice about how to raise children, but is that going to be what God would prescribe and give you the right kind of deliverance? I don't think so. Paul, did you have a...
In chapter 7, verse 10, although they're very good answers, but mm-hmm. He gives the real root answer, and that is our own self-pride.
Yes. The pride of Israel testifies against them, which, again, consistent with what Amos said, their arrogance. And, you know, they've been so wicked for so long and have turned against God, it sort of makes sense that when things go bad, well, we can't turn to the Lord. He's not on our side. We've forsaken him. He's not going to help us. What incentive does he have to help us? Although Hosea tries to explain that he loves them and wants them to turn back. But turning to the Lord would mean, I got to change my life. I got to shape up. I got to stop all this idolatry. I got to start treating the poor the way God wants it, you know, and that's unacceptable. So we'll find other solutions, quote unquote, to my problems that would not require me to change anything about my life, and I'll go with that. But of course, those efforts are doomed to fail. So entertainment. It's always amazing to me how celebrities, when they issue an opinion or a view about something, how much weight our culture gives to what the celebrities think about things. That's a poor substitute for the Word of God and the guidance that he gives. Social media, even our family, experts, yes, again, experts You get that from Google. Man's wisdom. Sometimes that can be of value, but if it defies what God says we need to do to deal with a problem in our lives, it's not going to be a usable substitute. All right. We're about out of time, but we have one last question. This is always our wrap-up question, right? To see if you were asleep or paying attention. Which of these four images is not used to describe Israel in this chapter we've just walked through? A cake not turned, a silly dove, a morning cloud, or a deceitful bow? Three of those are in this chapter. One of them is not. Which one is one that's not? Okay. A morning cloud. Now, that's a tricky one because chapter 6, I believe it is, does describe the loyalty of Israel as a morning cloud that evaporates, right? It's transient. Can't really rely on it. But these other three were the ones that are used here in chapter 7. All right. That is our last question. No perfect score today, but we've got a couple people, including our co-teacher, right, who got 4 out of 5. So if you got 4 out of 5, you're doing pretty well. I appreciate your attention today. I remember all the material that's available is on our website. Lesson 10 is up there already. There are printed copies of Lesson 10 for Wednesday night in the back. Philip has graciously agreed to teach for me on Wednesday as I'll be out of town the next couple of classes. But we appreciate your participation today.